tuned in to TechLoad, and in the studio we have three scientific technology experts from ANSTO's Australian Synchrotron. A warm welcome. There are three of them, so we're going to take it one at a time. I'm going to ask each of them three quick questions. We're going to look at highlights, challenges, and what amazes them about the tech that they deal with daily. So first we have Professor Michael James. He's the Senior Principal Scientist of Australian Synchrotron. Michael currently looks after a team of about 50 staff and postdoctoral fellows that operate the 10 operational beam lines. Hello, Michael.
G'day, Sandra. How are you?
Good. Now, have you got any highlights that stand out?
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about some of them later in the show, but we do a lot of research into new medicines at the facility. And when we get some of these medicines that are developed over the years and then they finally get out into production and start saving lives, it's kind of hard to beat that, to be honest.
Yeah, that's a satisfying day job.
Yeah. Well, we're helping other people do that. So people come to our facility from all over the world and we enable them to do this research that ultimately ends up curing people of various forms of cancer.
And affects us and the world we live in.
Yep.
What about challenges?
Challenges? Keeping up with technology. I know it sounds a bit crazy. We're a completely rich technology facility, but the technologies get reinvented every 5 to 10 years or so. And when they do, we actually have to scramble to make sure it all works again. And I'll
scramble. How would you define scramble? It's not very scientific,
well,
is it?
We can buy a new detector that's like 10 times more powerful than the existing ones. So something that would have taken 10 minutes all of a sudden takes 30 seconds. And then you've actually got to teach the robot to go faster, and then all the data you generate, you can generate 1,000 times the data that you used to do.
That's right, and the people aren't robots, so they're not perhaps moving as fast as you'd like to get the robots to move.
Well, the scientists who come to the facility, they don't like waiting for things, so they want things to be ready and going all the time. So.
And what amazes you about the technology on a day-to-day basis?
So where we work, the thing that really gets me going is the fact that it's so applicable across a huge range of areas. You know, pick a subject, and we like to say that somehow we're doing research that helps to either benefit people or to do crazy new things all the time.
Excellent. And next we have Dr. Letizia Summit. She's a senior scientific software engineer. And hello, Letizia.
Hello.
So what is a highlight for you so far that you've had?
So actually I think it was actually the Open Day that just passed. So we're a relatively young team at Scientific Computing. So the idea of scientific computing is only starting to catch on, the importance of computing power and development in science. And so through the Open Day, we got to all come together as a team and develop something that was fun and interactive for the crowds. And just seeing the people come through and being excited
and interested. I was one of those people, and I was amazed, and I was so proud to be able to see what I could see, and the way that the people, the scientists, the technologists could explain things. And no question was too simple, and they explained things so well and so beautifully. And I was very proud that we have such a facility in Australia.
Yeah. So that was really amazing to see all the people come through and to be able to develop something that was fun and interactive, but also displayed what we do as a team and as a group and as a facility. So that was my highlight, I think, for now. Yeah.
And challenge?
Challenges that we face are similar, as Mike mentioned, keeping up with technology. So in computing, there's always new technologies and it's moving so fast. And so being able to keep up with the new things that are coming and also apply them and adapt them to what we need and to bring all of those different technologies together in order to get the final outcome.
So we need another word for challenge, don't we? Challenge upon challenge upon challenge.
Yeah.
And what about what amazes you day to day?
So I think the science really amazes me. So in computing, we get very bogged down in our work, in our jobs. But then when we look up and think about what we're doing is actually achieving in terms of the science. So like I've seen possible dinosaur eggs down there, the possibility of, say, as Egyptian sarcophagus, or studying like whole trees. It's amazing the types of science that we can do. And so taking a look up and actually seeing what our work goes to contribute has been really amazing.
Wow. And we have Mike Larry. Now, Mike was originally from Wisconsin, so we will have to get to that. He moved from California. You'll hear that when he speaks. And he has a bachelor in physics, and he looks after 24/7, so he never sleeps. He manages the operations team. Hi.
Hi, Sandra. Yes, I do never sleep. That's a little unknown fact about me, but thanks for putting that out there.
And so what are the highlights for you so far?
A highlight for me, well, about a year ago, the accelerator ran for 1,000 hours uninterrupted. So no faults, no downtime, just 1,000 hours, which is about 2 months of running continuously.
Wow, did you get a holiday back to California for that?
I took a short break in the middle of it, yeah. finally caught a nap, actually. It was very nice.
Really? You must have been able to trust your team.
I do. I have a great team that assists me in this endeavor. So, yeah, it's really great. That was a real proud moment. It might have been the best in the world, but no one wants to tell us if we won. So.
Yeah, and how did was it difficult to get to that point, to be able to pull all that together for that record?
It was the end of a lot of work of solving problems one by one and identifying the systems that were causing the most downtime and resolving them, which is a process that's still ongoing even now. We have not by any means fixed all the problems. So as we identify more, we keep fixing them and we keep making it
better. Well, or else you'd be replaced by a robot.
Right. God, don't want that to happen.
And challenges?
What's sort of what Mike and Letizia touched on was just it's not just the technology. The accelerator field continues to develop apace with the rest of the world. So we have to keep up with that. And that's always a challenge. There's other facilities like ours that do similar work. And in order to stay relevant, we have to stay competitive. And that's still happening right now.
Yeah. And what amazes you?
For me personally, the sheer elegance of the systems that all have to work together to make the facility run. We're talking nanosecond precision timing on devices that are like micron precision movements and detectors that all have to come together, the 140 staff members that all work together to make this facility work.
Could you say you're a good multitasker?
I kind of have to be, yeah. I don't know if I'm good at it.
I'm kind of getting that.
I sort of have to be, yeah.
Can you tell us, Mike, what is the synchrotron and what does it do?
Sure. Well, a synchrotron is a kind of particle accelerator. Synchrotrons, by the way, were invented by an Australian physicist, Mark Oliphant, something like 70 years ago. And a synchrotron stores a series of charged particles moving very near the speed of light. And ours stores electrons in particular and uses those electrons as they pass through magnetic fields to generate X-rays. And we do science with those X-rays. In a nutshell, that's what a synchrotron is.
And Michael, why does Australia have a synchrotron and how did it come about?
So most developed countries have synchrotrons. They come in different shapes and sizes. Some can fit in a room and others are a kilometre and a half in circumference. So we've got a medium-sized synchrotron. And they let you...
Does size matter?
To some degree, but even our sort of modest-sized synchrotron performs outrageously well. And without that capability, there's science that you just cannot do. And so we had a sort of slightly sad record. At one point, we were the only advanced OECD country that didn't have a synchrotron. And there were plenty of other countries that also had them. Mm-hmm. But that was all sorted out close to two decades ago now when they first funded and constructed the whole facility. So if you want to do the sort of advanced science that we're going to talk about throughout the program, you've got to have one of these tools to do it.
Mm-hmm. And there are lots of different divisions and departments, and so there are, I think there are 50 guest rooms, for example. Yep. It's quite a big complex. And how would you summarize what the facility and complex looks like? And
yep. So the synchrotron itself is in this big round building, and it's about the size of the playing field of the MCG.
And it looks like a maze a little bit.
So that's where the accelerator is. And so for the researchers that come to use the facility, they never get to go into the maze of tunnels, as we call them, where the accelerator sits. And mostly they... I know it's a bit sad for other Mike here who runs the accelerator, but most of the scientists who come, they don't care about it. They just want the X-rays to be there when they need them, and they want Letitia's work to control everything precisely to happen flawlessly. And then they work with my team, the science team, to design the experiments and make it all come together.
Mm. I must admit, getting back to the VR experience, that, you know, to physically be there was and is amazing. But to be able to have the Google Cardboard or whatever it was originally and to see the relevance and the context of all the different moving parts at the facility and with the synchrotron was just incredible.
So there's an app you can download from the iStore. It's called Ansto.
Ansto XR.
Yep.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You probably want to do it on your Wi-Fi because it's quite a large file, MP4 file to download. But once you've got it, you can basically take a virtual tour through the whole facility, and by spinning your phone around, you can go and look in different parts of the whole place You'll meet some of our scientists and you get to investigate some of the technologies and techniques that we run at the facility. So
yeah, and it's great that you can put all of this into context, and sort of like it just brings everything alive. And, you know, the different scientists have things to say, and then they can explain why this is going on and how this happens. But I must admit, I definitely want to go back to the VR experience. It's a lot to absorb. You know, what's the research and the researchers component and the commercial aspect?
So we have researchers come from all over the country, and indeed people fly from all over the world to come and use the synchrotron. It's really nice actually when someone drives past their local synchrotron, hops on a plane and flies over the top of their synchrotron to come to us.
Wow.
Because that means that they really value what we do, and some of our capabilities are really unique. So anyway, that's a bit of an aside. So commercially, probably the bunch of researchers that have the most commercial impact that work with us are actually pharmaceutical companies who are developing new types of medicine. Mm-hmm. So researchers, again, from all over the world access our capabilities to study basically the atomic structure of proteins. And proteins are in all of us. They're in our body. They're in all parts of life. And when diseases take place, invariably there's something going wrong with the machinery of our bodies, which are proteins. So researchers want to try and work out ways of either telling the proteins to behave themselves.
Oh, how do you do that to a protein?
Well, you make a drug that fits into a little nook into the protein and switches it on or switches it off. So, you know, when you've got cancer, for example, it's cells that are not dying properly. And if you can work out the protein responsible for telling the cells to die, mm-hmm. and you can tell it to behave itself by giving it a drug, then you can actually take a form of cancer and treat it at the molecular level with a very specific medicine that doesn't have so many horrible side effects.
So you could have commercial companies coming to your facilities for this, and you could also have researchers from the universities also coming with similar things.
Yeah, so we have people from universities. We have people from what are called medical research institutes. There's a great new medicine that's been developed by a medical research institute here in Melbourne called the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute. They've developed a new drug to treat a form of leukemia. The drug's called venetoclax.
Was that released this year?
It was released just a couple of years ago now, but it took them, you know, the best part of a decade of research into what's the protein in that form of leukemia, how to isolate it, how to solve its atomic structure, how to work out the drug target to mix with it to make it work. So they've done all this work, and when they finally got the drug into clinical trials here and in the US, the American Food and Drugs Administration saw that results of that trial and said, for heaven's sake, just get it out to people. You know, that thing works so well, it's amazing. Get it to the people who need it the most. So it's saving people's lives now who have this really nasty form of leukemia.
So do you say that the facilities and the technology with the synchrotron just helped to facilitated that and helped fast track this so that it was so successful? Do you think there is a component in that?
It's a complete component. I don't want to downplay the role that Walter and Eliza do with their work, but without the tools of the synchrotron, they wouldn't have been able to get to the final design of venetoclax, the drug. They basically made precursors that weren't working so well, and then they went back and worked with us. I mean, they did all the heavy lifting. We just provided the tools, and they were able to design the final molecule that's doing all the amazing work in saving people's lives.
I might ask Mike. Mike, can you just explain the different... You've got 10 beams there at the facility. Can you explain the 10 different types of beams, you know, roughly, or the different purposes, or how there might be differences between some of the beams?
Sure. And Mike, feel free to jump in here and correct me if I'm a little bit wrong about this. But the electron beam goes around the entire circumference of the facility 1.4 million times per second. And it's during this process that it emits X-rays, which are what enable the tools to be used at the beam lines, like the MX beam line doing the work for the Walter and Eliza Hill Institute. What separates each beam line out is its suite of tools on the beam lines, but on the accelerator side is the components within the accelerator housing that either increase or shape the kind of magnitude of the X-rays or the infrared radiation that it's getting out. That can be one of a kind to our facility and one of a kind to each beam line.
And so how does it work? Can you have lots of different projects and experiments and researchers and commercial companies working at the facility at the same time, or do they have to book time?
Well, it works very well, for starters. All 10 are running simultaneously at any given time, the 10 beam lines. Where individual researchers fit in on individual beam lines is a product of selection process that undergoes that is specific to each beam line. And perhaps Mike can jump in here and talk a little bit more about that.
So we run the accelerator either 5-day week or a 6-day week. And when it's on 24. So it's not 24-7, it's 24-5 or 24-6, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, you have a day for maintenance.
Yeah, just to keep everything tuned up. So when the researchers come, they'll either come for just several hours at a time that do the really high-intensity experiments. Other people will come for a few days. Some people will come for a whole week and bring an experimental team to run 24 hours a day, day after day, for the whole week, which is why we have the really nice guest house out the back.
Exactly. I was just on the... I'm glad you've read my mind, because I was thinking, oh, are you running a resort?
No, there's nothing resorty about this. Everyone's there to go hard and work hard.
You do have a cafe and a theatre, I noticed.
Yeah, we have a great cafe there, but the guest house is where people stagger to bed at 3 in the morning just to recharge so they can get back on the tools at...
They're making the most of the time that they
have. Yeah, so we sort of have this cliche that every photon is sacred. every X-ray that we generate, all the light that we generate, we've got to use it because it's so...
valuable.
Yeah, it's not so difficult to make, but it's once you've got it, you've got to use it. So the people come to the facilities, they may only have 1 or 2 days of beam in every few months or maybe even once a year. Mm-hmm. So they go hard to try and get the best results out of it during that time.
Let's ask Leticia, you're looking after, in this current role, big data management. What does that involve?
Yeah, so as Mike was saying, so we have lots of users coming through. We have thousands of users every year coming through, and they all have different access to their instruments. And so we provide them with access to their data afterwards as well for processing for as long as they need to. So we have petabytes of data coming through every year. We'll store up to a petabyte every year. So if you want to think about that, that's like a million gigabyte thumb drives that we have to look after every year. And so that level of data requires a lot of infrastructure on our end. And so we need to make sure that we can keep up to that. And so we provide a tool that the users can interact with their data off-site, so they can do it from the comfort of their own home, their own home institution. And so we also look after that as well. That's been developed in-house, so that's something unique to the Australian Synchrotron as well. So we like to provide that service to our users.
And in terms of computer power, I might just ask Mike, what's the computer setup like? I think you have, 40 servers? Or I think you also mentioned earlier when we were speaking that it's virtual. Some of the computers.
I might just kick this one back over to Letizia.
Yeah, so in order to provide the computing power that we need, we can simulate computer machines. Mm-hmm. So there's virtual machines on our local servers, for example. That's a similar way that we run ASCII as well. We simulate these sessions for the users. And yeah, so we simulate our computing power that way, but we base that on our structures at the facility.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just to put it in perspective, there are literally thousands and thousands of computers that all need to be running perfectly in order for the facility to operate.
Mm. Is that something Mike takes care of? Or is he looking
They wouldn't let me anywhere near those. Rightfully so.
Okay. He needs to make sure that all the lights are green, but someone else needs to make sure all the computers are running. And so we don't want actually thousands and thousands of separate physical computers lying around the place because they're hard to maintain and hard to keep all the software up to date and all the rest of it.
Okay, that makes sense.
So we create hundreds of computers virtually on one actual physical box. And so these are the virtual machines that Letitia's talking about.
Okay. Yeah, Mike, talk us through what your department does and what the responsibilities are.
My team, our first job is to keep the accelerator running. Like we've talked about it, we're getting 24 hours of researchers coming through 5 or 6 days a week. And that time is precious. It's thousands of dollars an hour to run the facility, and we need to make sure we are running properly.
So do you have to know a lot about everything?
Ideally, yes, I would know a lot about everything. In reality, I know a little bit about some things, and I try and sort of spread the knowledge around in my
team. The one thing is I don't know how to read your last name, because you're definitely not Mike, we won't even say it, but you're Mike Lafke.
That's right, Mike Lafke from Wisconsin. Thank you.
Okay, getting to Wisconsin, and why are you here in Australia? Is that rude question?
No. About almost 4 years ago now, I saw a job opening for an operator position here at the synchrotron, and I thought, well, I've never been to Australia before, and my wife hadn't been either, so we thought, why not? We'll give it a shot.
And where you come from, that's got a history with what you linked with today.
That's right. Although I never worked there personally, Wisconsin was the home of the first synchrotron light source, the first synchrotron dedicated for X-ray production, and sort of the grandfather of, in some ways, of the facility we run now. A lot of the technologies and the techniques of running this kind of facility had its roots there.
Mm-hmm. What's the longest experiment you've had running in the facility? Do we know roughly? What's the length of a long experiment? I've got information here, like it could run up to a few hours and up to 6 days. Has it ever gone? You know, that's about it, isn't it?
Yeah, people will come for a six-day experiment on some of our equipment that we have to run in ultra-high vacuum. So in order to look at, you know, single layers of atoms on a surface or new types of electronics, they can't have any other molecules or atoms anywhere near it that can contaminate that surface. So we run in a vacuum that's better than outer space.
Really?
And we work
That's a good plug. Do you want to say that again?
Well, if you go into our vacuum chamber and you try to breathe, you'll get less molecules of oxygen than you will if you're sort of 5 miles above the surface of the Earth or something like that. Anyway, so it's a really, it's a seriously good vacuum.
Yeah.
And we work really hard to keep it that way. So researchers, when they come and use that tool, they've got to be very careful on how they handle samples, and so there's a lot of training involved before they get down to business. Generically, when you come to the synchrotron, you want to do something that you can't do in any other way.
Mm-hmm.
So either you want to look at something with a precision you can't get with conventional X-ray sources, or you want to look at it in real time rather than just, you want to look at it at video speeds rather than just a still photo.
So you can see what we cannot see. You can see the invisible, and not only that, you can see it in a moving image.
In real dimension, in 3 dimensions in real time.
Yes. And
in high resolution. The invisible and high resolution.
Have we just created an advert?
I think people have done this before, but we like the sound of it.
We do. And if we look at, I think that I was reading something about infants and some research going into the lung and breathing capacity.
Yeah, so again, we're giving good plugs to Melbourne researchers here. So there's a group of researchers at a place called the Hudson Institute for Medical Research over at Monash. They're trying to understand lung function in premature infants.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're born prematurely, often your lungs are not fully formed and developed. And they have ways that they've developed with their X-ray imaging that they've done at our facility and also in Japan. Neonatal wards all over the world are now adopting new ways to resuscitate preterm babies based upon their work. The reason why they use the kind of X-rays we can generate is that our very special type of X-rays can see the soft tissue, whereas you think about an X-ray you get in a hospital, you can see the metal or you can see the bones,
but
you can't see the lung structure.
Right. So now you can really take a close look and you can see everything. You can be inside the human body.
So we can take 3-dimensional images, CT scans, computer tomography scans of soft tissue. We can see right down into exquisite detail. And the information they can get about lung function from those images, they can then take and translate it into the clinic. And they've changed the way they resuscitate newborn babies based upon this work.
That is life-changing.
It's pretty impressive. The amount of data, though, that they generate when they do that is truly terrifying.
And, is it, Letitia? Are you terrified when you see some of that data coming through?
Yes, definitely. Because we know we have to deal with it, but no, it's fine. It's all in our process.
Yeah, just a note, I'm terrified being here in the studio with three technology scientific experts.
We're terrified being here with one radio host, so it's pretty even.
Putting cancer cells to sleep, that was fascinating. What's that about?
So this is some work that was published last year in the journal Nature, which is a really great high-profile journal. Some researchers found some molecules that are completely new. And you think about chemotherapy. You know, most people that have had cancer treatment with chemotherapy, it's a really brutal thing that takes place.
It's killing cells.
Yep, not only does it try and kill the cancer, but it sort of attacks your body at the same time. It's very debilitating. These guys have worked out, again, some proteins in certain types of cancer that with their molecules, their new drugs that they're developing, almost hypnotize the cancer and say, sleep.
So it's new age.
Well, it just tells the cells to go quiet.
Yeah. It turns the switch off.
Yep. And at that point, the body's natural immune system can just attack the cancer. And so the cancer's not fighting back. It's put into a state of
sleep.
And so it's a new approach to fighting cancer that's not brutal like radiotherapy and chemotherapy. It's not out there yet.
They'll have to manage it very carefully. The technology may be expensive, and this will be something that everybody would want to be able to have if they were suffering such a condition.
Well, look, invariably, in order to bring a drug to market from sort of concept and fundamental research, takes about $1 billion to do that. I know it's sort of crazy money.
Mm. But 10, 20 years, sometimes 12.
So these guys have got the fundamentals of it all sorted out by the work they do with us, and then they're working with industry partners to commercialize the medicines and bring it to market. And if they get that through all the clinical trials, that's going to be a really big thing because it's
huge.
A completely new way of treating
and that may come out of Australia.
Absolutely.
It will. It is coming out of Australia.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is hot off the press. We may not have it in our hospitals or our clinics, maybe for another 5, 10, 20 years. We don't know, but it's still hot off the press news.
Yeah, it's one of the blessings and the curse. We see this research done at our place, and a lot of it we go, that is just staggeringly cool. But hold your breath for a few years until it actually becomes available at the pharmacy. So
that's right, but you guys are working on it. So, Michael, can you talk us through the complexity of the facilities?
No, the team really is complex. But
okay.
No. So to run the facility, it's not just scientists, it's not just accelerator physicists, and it's not just computer programmers and IT specialists, but we have engineers, we have technicians that make amazingly fine-tuned and accurate parts for our systems and instruments that we run. We have facility folk that make sure the whole place operates as well. We finance, HR, the whole thing you'd expect in a scientific organisation. And we're basically, ANSTO itself has actually run out of Sydney, so we're a small part of a larger organisation.
Okay, you've got three sites, haven't you?
Yeah, so the main site's at a place called Lucas Heights in Sydney, where they run the OPAL research reactor and a lot of other scientific equipment as well. Then there's a smaller site at Camperdown at a hospital near Sydney University, where they run a cyclotron, which is much smaller than ours, but it's for producing what they call radiopharmaceuticals for either cancer therapy and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got our facility, which is sort of standalone here in Melbourne, mm-hmm. But we have 140 staff that run the place mm-hmm. at the moment.
I think there's a question we had earlier in terms of the commercial aspect. Are there likely to be spin-offs from the commercial organization?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about drug discovery, but it's actually some of the smaller things that are kind of impressive as well. People will come and use the synchrotron to learn something new, and then they'll take those ideas and technology and spin them off into different inventions and different companies even that come out of that. Some researchers at Monash University used our infrared light to be able to detect malaria very quickly using infrared mm-hmm. signatures out of single blood cells. And they took that knowledge and expertise and they developed their own little system that's portable. They don't need something the size of the MCG anymore to be able to measure that. And now they've actually taken it out into the clinic so they can go anywhere in the world, get a tiny pinprick of blood, and in an instant tell that patient whether they've got malaria or not. So they don't need a pharmaceutical company and to take vials and send it off to hospitals.
It's amazing. When I was there at the open day on Sunday at the synchrotron, they said that there was some technology that they had bought that had come from CERN. I don't know whether or not any of you know about that technology, and I was going to ask Mike about CERN.
Well, CERN is a quite a big lab in Europe, a multinational laboratory that supports a variety of accelerator research and particle physics research and a whole bunch of other spin-off research too. We are partnering with Melbourne Uni to take possession of some what's called X-band RF technology.
Yes.
It's a lot to unpack in that statement right there, but we're working with Melbourne Uni to bring this to Australia's locally, first at Melbourne Uni and then maybe to the synchrotron in time. We'll see if that...
And this was developed or has been used in CERN?
It's sort of been partially built in CERN, built but not fully realized. And we're hoping to build up a lab with Melbourne Uni and other partners to more fully realize the technology.
Okay.
The short version on what X-band RF can do is it's an order of magnitude more power in your accelerating structure. So for a particle accelerator, you need to be able to accelerate particles. Mm-hmm. Conventional ways of doing that have been around for a long time, like I said, about 70 years. And an X-band would be a huge leap forward to that. It's just kind of...
Is it like an upgrade, or this is really something new? It's an extra arm?
It's more than an upgrade. I mean, the sort of theory behind it has been around for a long time, but no one's been able to make it work. We've sort of been homing in on it for a long time. And so inheriting this technology that's been developed so far from CERN and building the expertise in the background here will be a huge boost for us at the synchrotron, also likely for Melbourne Uni. And there's potential, I don't want to bury the lead too much here, but there's potential spin-off technologies there too that in the fullness of time we will hopefully realize.
And the difference between the synchrotron and CERN, CERN has two beams of light colliding, or...
CERN has two colliding beams of protons typically, occasionally other ions too, but protons for the most part. And they're actually, their big one, the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, is the end game of a series of accelerators that work together to accelerate those particles. And whereas they smash together the protons to study the kind of insides, we don't smash anything, at least not deliberately.
Nothing's colliding, only maybe collide. Some staff members.
The odd electron
the scientists with
into
HR.
A wall. That's right. But we store our electrons for long periods of time, hopefully for days or months at a time, even so that the visiting scientists can come and use that time as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Art. What has art got to do with the synchrotron?
Yeah, so we have this wonderful beamline at the facility called the X-ray fluorescence microprobe. That lets us see different elements in materials. It doesn't matter whether it's a piece of art or down to a single cell almost. So long story short, if you go to the National Gallery of Victoria in St Kilda, there's a painting there by Edward Degas, the French Impressionist, called Portrait of a Woman. Mm-hmm. It's upstairs and sort of a little hidden away, but it's there. And researchers have known for a long time that underneath that painting that you can see with the naked eye is another face hidden underneath there. And we have a portrait within
a portrait.
That's right. And we have a way of measuring the elements in every single pixel, and the different elements correspond to different colours. And we can do that as a function of depth down into the painting.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that anywhere else in Australia. You have to come to the synchrotron and do it here.
Actually, some of the images I saw on the open day, like plants and different animals, the colours and the artwork was just fascinating. And that was down to the molecular structure.
Yeah. So, look, with Portrait of a Woman, there's a lady buried underneath, and we've been able to reveal her to the world.
Do you think that the painting underneath was better than the one above, or you're not going to say?
I'm going to play the fifth on that one. I wouldn't like the folk at NGV to get upset with me.
We're not art critics. Please don't ask us questions.
There's only so much you can do in a day, right?
Thank you for that save, Mike. That was great. But basically, it's just a wonderful piece of art. And the beauty of it, when that work was published, there was a Degas exhibition at the NGV at the time. And reporters from all over the world went crazy for it. Mm. And it revealed a whole new technique and technologies that we were able to develop and showcase to historians and art restorers, and indeed people that think they have a Rembrandt in their attic.
That's right. So who would have thought? And then I was also reading that there's Ned Kelly, and there was a self-portrait of somebody who was upside down. Really?
It's a really funny one. It's at the Heidi Museum of Modern Art out towards the Yarra Valley, and it's a Sidney Nolan painting, you know, the Ned Kelly series.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see the painting itself, you see these eyes peering out of a big black helmet, of course.
He doesn't have the helmet, does he?
No, we've subtracted it out in software. So we basically do the measurements with our X-rays. Mm. We throw it all to Letitia's team with our high-performance computing cluster.
With high-performance complex people.
And then we subtract it out in software, and we can give colour to the X-ray images that we generate, and you can see these hidden paintings that were never before seen.
That's right. We've only got a couple of minutes, but I'm so fascinated. I need to know about what are you doing in terms of... I do so much research. I could just come to the synchrotron and find out all about my nutrition, for example.
So there have been some researchers here in Australia for a while. The malnutrition is a big problem, but it's not necessarily a problem of calories.
No.
So people, you can eat rice and you can eat wheat, etc.
Nutrients or the micronutrients that are missing perhaps in the food source.
That's right. So think about sushi rice, okay? You get these beautiful polished grains of white rice, plenty of calories, no nutrition, because a lot of the nutrients, the micronutrients that we need, like zinc and iron, etc., are on the outside of the grains. So when your mum told you to eat brown rice and all the rest of it, she was kind of right.
Yeah.
Doesn't Thanks, taste Mom. So good, but so new forms of grains, rice, wheat and barley that have been developed have higher iron and zinc inside the kernel, and mm-hmm. we can see that.
Mm.
We can see the inside of these grains.
So you can also go about helping to correct that or being able to find the right seeds or the right improve the soil or do the case studies.
All sorts of things. So we've got people working on how to get better fertilizers into the right part of plants. We've got people who look at the grains themselves. We've got people that look at the processing and how to best do the food science to make the products that we want, but to not lose the nutritional value in the process of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Letitia, tell us about Homeward Bound. So, interesting enough, we don't know. I think the women in the science technology fields are on the increase. But how does this link with Homeward Bound?
So the idea behind Homeward Bound, so it's a leadership development program for women in STEM, and it's to improve their leadership and strategic capabilities to help inform the decisions for the future of our planet. So the idea is to bring a strong collaboration of women from around the world. And so we have leaders from all fields, to bring them together so that we can empower each other and work towards a different decision-making regime for the mm-hmm. future of our planet.
And, yeah, and you also touched on, which is another topic which we've just run out of time, so you, the three of you will just have to come back very soon. I wanted to talk about climate change impacts on the Great Barrier Reef. I wanted to touch on the improvement to our environment and the reduction of CO2 emissions, but all of that will have to wait.